Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hello, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How are you?
I'm well.
Yeah?
I want to talk today about rising food prices.
Rising food prices. That's when the food prices go up?
That's when the food prices go up.
That's what's going on now?
Well, it's what's going on with most of the food now, but it seems as though the rising food prices are not affecting as badly, and in some cases not at all, the kinds of foods that we talk about, which are, to be honest, on the more expensive end of the spectrum.
Which were always on the more expensive end of the spectrum.
There's an article in the Times recently. Kim Severson, who's been on our show, wrote a wonderful article. It's called Good News About Rising Food Prices. That's right. She says good news about rising food prices. And it's an interesting paradigm she identifies. She writes, while grocery shoppers agonize over paying 25% more for eggs and 17% more for milk, Michael Pollan, the author and de facto leader of the food intellectuals, happily dreams of small, expensive bottles of Coca-Cola. Along with some other critics of the American way of eating, he likes the idea that some kinds of food will cost more, and here's one reason why. As the price of fossil fuels and commodities like grain climb, nutritionally questionable high-profit ingredients like high-fructose corn syrup will rise as well. As a result, Cokes are likely to get smaller and cost more. Then the argument goes, fewer people will drink them, or they'll drink less of them. Now, the idea behind this article, and it's a very well-written and a large article that I can pay full, that we can fully address here, but is that the kind of foods that are highly processed, bad for the environment, bad for you, have a large carbon footprint, are the ones that are being that are artificially cheap.
Well, let's talk about the
Ones that are being that are seeing the prices rise.
Let's talk about the main food that we're talking about, the biggest food commodity that is artificially deflated is corn.
Well, it's subsidized by the government, but
artificially deflated. I'm sorry,
right? It's the prices of corn in America are artificially low because we pay out huge subsidies not to individual farmers but to huge agribusiness corporations to make more corn than we need, so that our big food processors can get cheap ingredients. What this does is it puts small farmers in Mexico and other, like even corn farmers in Mexico, puts them out of business, drives them off the land. They then migrate here in search of work. We then want to kick them out. Corn uses a lot of fossil fuels. It's transported a great distance. It uses petroleum-based pesticides.
But we're producing more corn right now. And the reason we're producing more corn right now is ethanol. Now, I'm not a proponent of ethanol, though I love the idea of studying it and learning more about it and learning how it's used. I think that corn is not a great use for ethanol because it's so highly intensive in petroleum. It takes so much petroleum to make
the
corn. Well,
and it takes a lot of water, and it takes a lot of pesticides, and most of the corn in America is genetically modified. But in any event, this artificially cheap corn, which is now, you know,
artificially cheap high fructose corn syrup.
And what's funny is we're still subsidizing these farmers who are making huge profits now because of the demand for corn, and have been making very good profits all along. Your family farm, by the way, is generally not subsidized. And what the people that are talking about these rising prices of these foods that are nutritionally questionable and not so great for the environment is, do we, and meat falls in there because meat, we feed our corn-fed beef is a big part of our diet. The question is, yes, the price of food is going up, but let's face it, everybody, we're fat. Okay?
Well, and let's face it, everybody, food has been artificially cheap, okay?
Some kinds of food.
Some kinds of food, but if McNuggets cost the same amount as real chicken, would that be a bad thing? And I think that's the question that Kim is asking. Would that be a bad thing? And obviously the answer is no. If it costs the same to put high fructose corn syrup in your Coca-Cola as it does to put sugar in your Coca-Cola, would that be a bad thing? And, well, and my argument is no, it would not.
And if Coca-Cola is a little more expensive,
mm-hmm.
and so, you know, there is not an incentive for some fast food chains say, yeah, you get a 64 ounces
for 10 cents more than the 10 ounce.
Right. And they say, well, wait a second, we have to charge for that. Is it such a great thing that the kinds of food that are not good for us and not good for our planet and not good for our farmers are so cheap? And I'm not sure that it is. And it's always...
Well, you're sure that it's not.
Right. Well,
you're sure that it's not.
And the fact of the matter is also, well, we eat too much of that kind of food.
Mm-hmm.
And look, a lot of us are obese. So if we had to cut down your 64-ounce Coke to a 32-ounce Coke or a 28-ounce Coke, or like we had 25 years ago...
An 8-ounce Coke.
8-ounce Cokes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a normal serving. Was that a horrible thing? I think it's a very good thing. Now, remember, in the current system, organic farmers are not subsidized. Vegetable farmers are generally not subsidized.
Mm-hmm.
People who grow outside the mainstream of the beef industry are generally not subsidized. So they're also, when people have grass-fed beef that doesn't eat corn, and it's raised locally, so it doesn't rely a lot on transportation fuels, and it's grown organically, so it doesn't use a lot of petroleum-based fertilizers and pesticides, well, the rising fuel prices aren't affecting those people
mm-hmm.
as much. And so maybe...
If your cow's eating grass doesn't really cost anymore because ethanol's being produced. Grass is grass, and it grows out in the backyard, and the cows eat it.
And if this brings the kinds of good foods that we always talk about into the realm of competitiveness for price, and you have to pay a little more for them rather than a lot more, I don't think that's a bad thing for society. And it's funny because people criticize Alice Waters here all the time. People have criticized us for saying, well, you know, you propose a diet that only rich people who go to Whole Foods can eat. Look, Whole Foods makes it easy, and Whole Foods charges a price. But, again, I posit that a lot of us could probably eat less than we do.
Well, I'll also posit that if you're eating seasonally and you're eating from your local markets, one of the great secrets, I guess it is still today, is that at a lot of these local food markets, you're getting or have available to you organic foods and good-for-you foods that are coming from local producers that are the same or cheaper than the tomatoes that are coming from Guatemala that are on your standard supermarket shelf.
Well, and you bring up a good point. Shopping at your local farmer's market can often be as inexpensive or less expensive than shopping at your supermarket, and the prices are certainly more comparable because you're cutting out the middleman. You're buying right from the farmer. But I guess what I'm saying is when you go into a hamburger joint and you pay 79 cents for a burger, you know that there's no way that
mm-hmm.
someone could produce that without externalizing a lot of those costs, and you know that it's not good for you. And, you know, maybe you don't get to have two Big Macs.
When Francis talks about externalizing those costs are either in your water that's no longer potable because of the pesticides that have floated into it, or someone else
pays the cost.
Right.
Someone else pays
the cost in pollution
somewhere.
Or in worker or right, exactly. Or maybe it's just the fact that it's really, really bad for you, and there's a societal cost to that as well.
It's always hard to argue the position that, see, for me, I hate Walmart, right? So I think Walmart does a lot of bad things. Some people disagree with me. I think that's fine. I subscribe to WalmartWatch.com. Walmart does bring cheaper prices to the consumer, at least initially and maybe overall. But if that, and I'm not saying this happens necessarily because I don't want them to sue me, but if a Walmart in your town brings you 10% cheaper prices on hardware and groceries and other stuff, but the hardware store closes and the pharmacy closes and the florist closes and all those people are out of work and your downtown is a boarded up downtown, is your life really better because your groceries
mm-hmm.
are 10% cheaper? I mean, are they really? You know what is? That's what I talk about externalizing the cost. The cost is Walmart. The cost of Walmart you have to factor in shutting down your downtown.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, well, we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to be talking with Andrew Zimmern of Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern, one of the best shows on the Travel Channel, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And our guest today is Andrew Zimmern. He is the associate editor and dining columnist for the Minneapolis St. Paul magazine. But he is also host of the Travel Channel's Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern. You can find out more about him at andrewzimmern.com. You link there through our website at restaurantguysradio.com.
Andrew, welcome back to the show.
Hey, guys.
It's
great
nice
to be here.
It's nice to have you back. Lots of things have happened since we first had you on the show. You've exploded.
Well, let's just call a spade. The two of you are the most prescient, knowledgeable food industry insiders in a global sense. And the minute that you took golden scepter and knocked me over the head with it, the show took off. So let's just be honest and share the credit where it's due.
That's going to go on a clip for our
things have definitely changed since the last time that we talked. The show's become very, very popular. The network tripled their order. We're already filming the third season, even though we're still shooting the second one. And, you know, the big book deals started happening. The sponsorships started happening, and it's a little overwhelming. I have to say, you sort of never plan on being in this position. And then when it sort of happens, you're just so grateful and so humbled by it all as you're having a nervous breakdown.
I was going to say, while you're clobbered by the enormous work of it all at the same time.
Yeah, it's kind of insane. Someone in my office took a calendar the other day to try to explain to me how bad things were, and I said, it's not that bad. And they showed me that in a 90-day period, even though I was in the country for like 4 weeks during that 90-day period, I was only in town in my hometown for 4 days.
Wow.
Excuse me? This is the life of the superstar, Andrew. You're just going to have to accept it.
I don't know. It's the stuff they don't hear. I mean, I now have a lot more sympathy for the, drug-addled 20-year-old movie starlets. I understand. You know, thank God I'm 16 and a half years sober.
That's good. No, you know, and now you have no more eating, filet mignon in restaurants. It's just not allowed anymore.
You know something? It's so crazy. It's funny that you say that because I'll go out to dinner with my wife and my son, the local burger place, and someone is trying to scoop something out of the garbage and serve it to me and send it to the table with a cute note. I'm just like, my God, stop already.
No.
I need a hamburger.
Well, honestly, Francis and I have the same problem having one of our restaurants is a very high-end restaurant. So I'll go to a friend's house, and they want to make me a gourmet meal. And I'm like, meatloaf, okay?
Stop it. Exactly. I want pot roast.
That's
now,
the stuff.
I understand that Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern is, is it the most popular show on the Travel Channel?
Yeah, half the season last year, we were trading one and two spots with Tony's show, which was all on the same night, which was Monday night.
That's Anthony Bourdain's show called No Reservations on the same network.
That's right. And, half the season, his show was number one, half the season, mine was number one. And you look at things two ways. There's ratings in terms of percentage of household, and then there's demographic. So they're the two separate ratings criteria. And, we did a fabulous, fabulous job last season for the network in terms of both, as did he. This year, remember, we did such a great job that they moved me onto my own night. Then once that happened, his show, I think, is in hiatus in between season 4A and 4B. I'm in the middle of season 2A, mm-hmm. And I think the last 5 weeks that my show has been on, we've been the highest-rated program.
So last year you did 12, 14 shows, and this year you're going to be doing more?
About almost 40 if you include the specials.
Wow.
Now, all right, so what is the key to the ratings? Is it the more bizarre food you eat or the more bizarre the food is that the ratings go up? What is the key to the most highly rated shows?
It really depends on what happens within the context of each show. I'll tell you a funny story. Season number one, the most watched and talked about episode, and the most watched and talked about scene in that episode, I didn't even eat anything. It was when the witch doctor from Ecuador abused me naked in his office, which is why they decided to do a pilot with me called Bizarre Worlds, where I don't eat anything. But I'm just out getting abused by witch doctors in foreign countries. I've argued successfully to have some food thrown into the mix there, because I don't want to take away or dilute what I love to do. So on one hand, that's the biggest ratings bonanza, which is me being abused by someone, sort of the fish out of water stuff.
Uh-huh.
The other giant ratings bonanza is when you put something so outrageous, so fantastical into it, that it begins to dictate to people that this is sort of must-see television. The opening segment of our season 2A was the penis restaurant in Beijing, and it exploded out of the screen at people, no pun intended. And, you know, our head of programming, Matt Butler, actually said to people in a meeting very seriously, you know, penis equals ratings, and which is one of the all-time great humorous, you know, show meeting notes.
Now,
that's a quote.
Now, so that our listeners, before our listeners start calling up and lighting up the switchboard here, we're talking about a restaurant that serves animal penises.
That's right, 40 different types, and in luxury. I should tell you, it's about $300 a person, and you're served on gold service, and everything is done in private rooms. And you know, the Chinese, more so than any other people, believe that you eat for health. You eat foods that are supposed to cool you down when it's hot, heat you up when it's cold. You eat to maintain balance and to maintain your qi and your yin and yang.
We're gonna be back after the break and talk about Andrew Zimmern's yin and yang. We'll be back in just a moment.
Or my yin yang.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagatta and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Andrew Zimmern of Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern and AndrewZimmern.com. Before the break, we were talking about the penis restaurant. Can you continue to tell us about the penis restaurant?
Sure. It's a Guang Li Zhu is one of the most famous restaurants in Beijing, and it's got five or six private rooms. There's no public dining room there. You make a reservation, whether you're 2 or 20, you're put into a private room.
Well, you know, because listen, if you're going to eat penis, you want to be in a private room.
You need to be alone, especially given the size of some of them. And you order, you know, a series, a progression of courses. I started out with a soup that was a turtle soup that had a frog soup that had a snake's penis garnishing the top. And then all the way at the back end of the meal, we had a fantastic hot pot. You know, there's a turtle floating in this giant tub of fantastic broth and vegetables, and there's shrimp and other things in there, and out comes a three-tiered platter with seven different types of penis on it. And it was absolutely staggering. I can tell you that the braised yak penis in the soup was much better than the stir-fried spicy deer penis that I had as the course in between. I was not a big fan of the deer penis.
Now, I think that you may be leaving some of our listeners in the lurch when you talk about some penises in relation to how good they are in relation to other penises.
Yeah.
For those of us who've never had that at all, for our frame of reference, what is it like? Would you do it again? Is it delicious?
Absolutely. The donkey and yak penis is fantastic. Because I hate to use a cliche, and I don't intend this to be played for a yuck, although it's very funny. But bigger is better. The larger the member, so to speak, the longer they cook it and the more textures are involved, and so it ends up being a much more tender and succulent eating experience.
And there you have go ahead.
You know, it's very cartilaginous. It's much like some of the parts of a pig's foot would be, with very little, you know, meat and mostly cartilage. You have to remember, if any of you have pets at home, those dog bullies are sometimes the actual cartilage part of the penis that is used as a pet food, and that's often what is cooked. So something like a deer penis or a seal penis is so small in terms of that cartilaginous part that can be cooked that you actually end up with something that's very, very tough.
Interesting. All right, we'll be back after the news. More with Andrew Zimmern of Andrew Zimmern's Bizarre Foods, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
You may know Andrew Zimmern from his blog, Chow and Again, which you can find at andrewzimmern.com. He's also an associate editor and the dining columnist for Minneapolis St. Paul magazine, but you probably know him through the Travel Channel's Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern.
Andrew, in watching the show, one of the things that I realize is most of the people who you're talking to don't necessarily think their bizarre foods are all that bizarre. Is that true?
None of them do. And as a matter of fact, I think that's the gift of the show. One of our intentions, we never set out to do shock television. What we wanted to do was actually take people into other cultures and explore the foods of those cultures and along the way learn a couple of things. And, you know, if you try to explain Kraft American cheese singles to a Kalahari Bushman, they're going to look at you like you're crazy.
By the way,
we are crazy.
I look at people like they're crazy.
Okay, Kraft American singles are crazy.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, you know, I'm an East Coast guy. You guys are on the East Coast. You know, when I moved out to Minnesota and everyone was saying on Sundays in church basements, everybody here eats lutefisk, which is, you know, dried cod soaked in lye and then rehydrated for 7 days so they can get the poisons out of it. And old white-haired grandmothers serve it to you with about a quarter pound of melted butter on it. I thought, that's crazy. It's the strangest thing I've ever heard. Why would you do that? There's perfectly good fish to be eaten all around you. But more lutefisk is eaten in Minnesota than in Norway, Sweden, and Denmark combined. So, you know, you've got these sort of pockets of enthusiasm for foods all over the world, oftentimes right in your own backyard. It's quite amazing how, you know, one man's weird really is another man's wonderful. Where in the part of the world where you guys are, you have a thing that I'm addicted to, thanks to my wife, called Taylor Ham.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And you know, if you start to explain that to somebody, I've tried to explain it here to Minnesotans, until they eat it, they're just like, "What is that? Sounds weird."
Yeah, it's sort of like the Northeast version of Scrapple, but much better.
Oh, so much better.
So much better. And on an English muffin with cheese and an over easy egg, so the egg yolk runs down your leg.
Bacon,
when you eat the
pork
sandwich.
Roll, egg, and cheese. There's, I mean, that's
the ultimate
Jersey
diner sandwich.
Exactly. John Bon Jovi's favorite food.
Oh, is it really?
It is.
I did not know.
I got a chance to chat with him about it once at a party. You know, everyone wants to, when you're at a music party, everyone wants to talk to the food guy.
Well, now you brought up a very interesting point. What was the name of the food that the lye-soaked salt cod that you talked about?
Lutefisk.
Okay. Now, you talk about it being more popular in Minneapolis, in the Minneapolis area, than it is in Scandinavia. And I think that brings up, it further buttresses your point about food being inextricably linked to culture.
Yes.
In that's an example of immigrants who are trying down the generations to hold on to what makes them special And so that is a part of their culture. And I think, you know, I'm Irish-American, and we do a lot of crazy things that, you know, like, you know, go to the St. Patrick's Day Parade in Dublin. It's nine guys in a bagpipe walking down, you know, some street. Go to the St. Patrick's Day Parade in New York. And then, you know, you've got the largest St. Patrick's Day Parade in the world. And I think with food, we do a similar thing. It's a way to identify ourselves culturally.
Sometimes it's a positive. Sometimes it's a negative. And exploring the stories there is fascinating. You're absolutely right. I mean, if you go onto the Upper East Side of New York and go over into Yorkville, into some of the old neighborhoods, there's more Hungarian and German delicatessens there than, you know, anywhere else outside of Germany. It's fascinating, and some of the best elements of those cultures are preserved. Go into Chinese restaurants in New York and order Kung Pao chicken. Get on a plane with your to-go order and go to Chengdu and order Kung Pao chicken and eat them side by side. And you can see sometimes how these syncretic dishes, as they're transported around the world, change. And in some cases, like the Kung Pao, in talking to chefs in Chengdu, they are absolutely crazy upset that the popularity of the unofficial Kung Pao-style chicken is going to dilute Kung Pao chicken back home as people return and are eager to taste what they've eaten in other countries and not what originated in Chengdu.
Now, is that what you mean when you say, you know, sometimes it works for good and sometimes it works for bad? Is that when you mean it works for bad, when things get diluted?
I think sometimes you're in danger of losing the dish forever. Food is a way to experience history. You know, we talked before on this program the last time that I was on about there are certain pathways. You know, I'm not arguing for the horse and buggy to come back, although with the situation with oil in this country, maybe that would be a good thing. But sometimes if you lose a way of cooking or a style of cooking, it can be lost forever because it's something that has to be, it's like theater. You can never see Marlon Brando in Streetcar Named Desire again.
Right.
On stage. And I think that as long as we have ways to preserve the traditions. You know, I'm on my way to Sicily. I just was in a pre-production meeting for a Sicily show, and, you know, it's an island. Thank God. Islands are the best thing for food preservation, art preservation. Everything there is so unique, uniquely unique, even given how localized Italian food is. I'm, you know, preaching your guys' language to you. But it's so localized that sometimes modernism has a way of destroying and trampling on culture, burying it under a foot of new rubble that sometimes can't be unearthed.
And also, you can't learn true cooking. You can't really learn how to make a dish by just reading a recipe out of a book.
Correct.
That it's
correct.
Taught from one person to the next person to the next person, and that's because it is an art, because there is a feel to it. That's
because
how it is.
Cooking is not always from a recipe, because ingredients are different, and you need to have the cook's palate, like a winemaker's palate. You know, we can follow the recipes for making wine like they made it, you know, 500 years ago, or making wine like they used in ancient Greece or Rome, but we're not really sure that's how they did it. Just like we're not sure that's how they pronounced Latin. We can write it, but can we speak it? I don't know.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
You know, it's funny that you talk about an island and islands being great places to preserve cuisine, because there are two things when I look at the cuisines of the world that, you know, we're sort of finding in sort of an original state that is not cosmopolitan.
For instance, the food of Long Island.
Well, you know, that that you bring up a good point there, because I think that islands and places that have experienced at least some time of poverty in the modern era, I think are often rich places to have cuisine, because if places are wealthy enough and cosmopolitan enough, they join the world palate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that in poor places, that they're stuck in their own tradition because they didn't have a choice. But, you know, thank heaven. Does that make
that's
sense?
Right. That's right. And remember, poverty equals cooking as well. I mean, in ancient Rome, in the wealthier households, when you look at ancient recipe books, they were eating roasted whole animals and eating primal and center cuts of them. It was in the, you know, it's in the slums of Morocco, you know, in, you know, 1,000 years ago that they're learning how to make, you know, soup with just bones and vegetable scraps.
Sure.
And it's the same way in our kitchens today. You know, there are a lot of great restaurants in this world that I go into and people are like, oh, isn't the food fabulous? This is some of the best cooking I've ever experienced. It's like, this isn't cooking, this is assembling and good purchasing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cooking is different than buying and assembling. And so oftentimes, even when you look at ancient cultures, if they were able to afford imported foods, if they were able, I mean, in in the 15th century in England, if you had a cinnamon stick in your house, it meant you were a very rich, wealthy man, and that's why cinnamon sticks are in every ancient recipe for roasted goose that you ever find from, you know, 15th century England all the way through 17th. It wasn't until much later on that they started to look all around them and say, oh, we can use spices and herbs and things that are grown here. So it does work on several different levels. I think your theory is a solid.
So many of your shows are focused on the parts of the animals that we don't eat in this country,
yep.
or
yep.
we choose not to eat in this country, or...
Well, we do. We eat them in very fancy restaurants now where the snout-to-tail movement has gained a toehold, but the rest of the world has been eating that way for thousands of years and never stopped.
Well, even here we were eating them for thousands of years, and then we stopped.
That's right. That's right.
Well, you know, but I think, Andrew, your point about, you know, in wealthy households, it's cooking that resides in large measure in the poor areas, at least historically, because...
Mm-hmm.
If you can, when the animal is slaughtered, if you're the rich person and you can afford to take the chops, the loin, and go home, well, all you do is basically season that, heat it up, and serve it with some mashies, right?
Yeah.
But if you're the poor person and your mother is presented with the intestines and the nose,
the capuzella,
and you better have some talent there to make that taste
good. Right.
That
is exactly, and that's why people are always like, they say, "Oh, did you really like that?" I'm like, really like it. It was fantastic because when that chef took the trotters and the liver and the heart and made a braise out of it with a little bit of bacon and vegetables and wine, it was transcendent.
Mm.
The guy that took the lamb chops and threw them on the grill, he didn't have much of a job.
Yeah, but I'd still like to go over to his house if he invited me.
I still like lamb chops. Sorry.
you're right, and I know that I know the point you're making. I mean, because you can extend that argument. If you don't eat cassoulet in the wintertime, you can't appreciate a perfect tomato in the middle of summer.
Absolutely.
And it's why eating with the seasons is important to everyone, and I make the same argument. We should be eating all, if you enlarge your diet and start, not only will you find new things that you like, but you're also going to be able to appreciate a lot of different foods and not remain a kind of jaded eater that expects, chops and sliced tomato salads 24/7, 365.
We're going to come back in just a moment, talk more with Andrew Zimmern of Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern on the Travel Channel and AndrewZimmern.com in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:46.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work. Until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Hey everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Andrew Zimmern of the Travel Channel's Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern. We've been talking about the effect of wealth on and class on food and food culture. We've been talking about different food cultures valuing different parts of an animal. Because, let's face it, vegetables are exciting, but animals are really exciting.
Yep.
Are there any parts of animals that are sort of universally taboo? Or is the whole animal eaten somewhere?
The whole animal is eaten somewhere. I mean, people always say, well, the bile from, different organs isn't eaten. It's like, oh, contraire. I mean, I just had it in Samoa and Hawaii with some tribal people that use it to season a soup.
Oh, okay. You got to share with me. How does that work exactly?
They actually stir the bile in and during the last couple minutes of cooking, and they love that sour, off flavor.
Huh.
Do you think that the American palate is bland compared to the rest of the world?
Oh, absolutely.
That we look for blander type foods than the rest of the world?
It's not that we look for blander. It's just that we've lost. We're only a couple hundred years old, and you know, as you accurately put, there was a time in this country where we ate everything, but we've lost such a connection that we, in this country, we put convenience and luxury so far high up on our cultural totem that we lose perspective on the possibilities of what to do
mm-hmm.
with the rest of our food life. I mean, it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy that we're neutering it. It's the two things that kill great food, speed and convenience. It doesn't mean that there's not, you know, good eating that can be had by something that's fast. It's just that those are two universal killers, and I think it's damaged us to a great degree. You know, we also are obsessed with the new here. You know, in Italy, I've got Italy on the brain because I'm going there in a week. You know, in Italy, they worship the new. I mean, there's more Nuova Cucina and progressive cooking going on in Italy than just about anywhere else in the world. But those chefs who are doing even the Italians that are getting into molecular gastronomy and, you know, putting spaghetti bolognese into a jelly bean are still not playing around with, you know, lobster amoricane. I mean, they're still putting yeah. spaghetti bolognese into a jelly bean. They're still cooking their food from their region,
right.
from their season.
But they're reverent of a tradition and reverent of.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In this country, and I mean, you guys are you know, are restaurant people, and you know, so you know it as well as anyone else. I can't tell you how many young people I meet with who come out of cooking school, they did a stage in a fancy restaurant, and they think they can become a chef. And the first thing they want to do is they want to start experimenting.
Mm-hmm.
The other night I was watching Top Chef, one of my favorite shows, and Tom Colicchio said something that I wish they had just frozen the tape and then replayed it again. He said, if you want to cook in a contemporary modern style, you have to know the classics.
Yeah.
And it's really true. I mean, the French Impressionist painters who were the first to kind of break out of the historical life painting mode were the greatest draftsmen in the world. They were like photorealists. They had such great skill because they learned it at the École des Beaux-Arts. But it wasn't until you could draw the human hand in perfect form that you could begin to experiment
yep.
with their impressions of the human form. And it's the same thing with food. We don't know ourselves. We've lost. Everyone wants what they want, and they want it now. It's the King Baby Syndrome, and young chefs are too desperate to become a superstar today, as opposed to learning the skill set that will allow them to create a career where they have the opportunity to be a superstar later on.
We've actually talked about that with Tom and some other great chefs, a guy in Chicago by the name of Grant Achatz, and that's exactly what we talked about, that you need to know the traditions and the basics and the building blocks, because those are the building blocks from which you can experiment. If you don't have those basics,
you're just a kid playing around in the
you're
kitchen.
Just a kid playing around with his with his chemistry set.
Right. Thomas Keller, who I worked for 2 years, told me, he said, there is a right way and a wrong way to cook everything. And what he meant was, he didn't say there's the only way. His point was, once you know how to roast a chicken, you can then roast it a million different ways, but you got to learn how to roast it first. I've experienced that with coconut grubs. You know, they don't know how to cook them in the Philippines, even though it's a part of their diet, but they sure do know how to cook them in Ecuador where they grill them. I mean, there's a right way and a wrong way to clean them and prepare them, and it doesn't matter whether you're dining in a jungle, sitting on an earthen floor eating grubs, or whether you're in a French Parisian temple of gastronomy. You know, good cooking is still good cooking. At the end of the day, it's got to taste right.
Well, it matters a little.
Well, Andrew, I tell you, every time we talk to you for an hour, it feels like I've left 3 hours untalked. So I hope you'll come back and join us again.
Anytime you guys want to have me on, let's set it up, because I love it works both ways. I love it myself.
Super. Andrew Zimmern, you have to check out his show on the Travel Channel, Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern. Also, go to andrewzimmern.com. You can link there through restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC, it's 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the restaurant guys. And Andrew Zimmer just won't hang up the phone. Actually,
I'm like a bad cold. I refuse to go away. Andrew, you guys ever going to come to Minnesota?
You know, I have some friends that I just spent the weekend with who are here back east who live in Minnesota, and they have invited me out there to do some ice fishing in Minnesota.
Do not say yes. Promise me. It is the kiss of death.
Well, it's boring.
Well, no, it's not that it's boring. It's just that Minnesotans love to mess around with folks like you. And so they say, yeah, come out for some ice fishing. And they drag. I mean, I really shouldn't say that. Winter is gorgeous up here. We go up to my in-laws' lake home. We snowmobile. We ice fish. We go out hunting. You go wolf watching. It's fantastic. But May through November, Minnesota is America's paradise, and it's the best-kept secret in the country. You come out here, I mean, it's not called Land of a Thousand Lakes for nothing. You can't get out into the Adirondacks unless you know someone who's got a great house. Up here, the whole state looks like that, and it's just paradise.
Wow.
Well, I'll tell you, my friends do have a bit of a droll sense of humor, so I could see them basically leaving me out in the middle of a river to freeze my...
Well, even if you come in winter, we'll go to my in-laws' house, we'll get on the snowmobiles, we'll go eat a good meal, we cook food in the fireplace, it's a lot of fun.
All right, so if you hear us running repeats one week, you'll know that
we're in Minnesota.
Minnesota.
Snowmobiling and not ice fishing.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, Andrew, it's been a blast. If I come out, it will not be for ice fishing, that's for sure. Thanks, sir.
Please, come out for the Minnesota State Fair. That's an eating orgy the likes of which you've never experienced.
That sounds like a blast.
I'm a huge fan of the eating orgy.
Well, listen.
Oh, we love that.
Andrew, if you don't hang up this time, you're going to have to come on the next show after the news. And that show's not even about food.
See you guys later.
All right, thanks, care.
Andrew.
Bye-bye.
Andrew Zimmer, and you can check him out at andrewzimmer.com. I did go ice fishing with my dad when I was a kid. I used to fish with my dad, hunt with my dad, and go ice fishing with my dad on Lake Apacon in northern New Jersey. The most boring thing I ever did in my life. And cold at that. And we put the little thing in the ice, and we drilled out the... Hated my life. Hunting, awesome. Ice fishing, no. I agree with Andrew on that one. All right, well, I hope you've enjoyed your hour with the Restaurant Guys. I know we certainly have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.